Hi, I'm retired NYPD Detective Vic Ferrari, and welcome to NYPD Through the Looking Glass, where you'll get unique insight into the New York City Police Department. Before we get started, please check out my Amazon author page, where you'll find my series of behind-the-scenes NYPD books for $10 paperback and $2.99 ebook download. Remember, Christmas is coming, so for $10, it's a great deal, and you can preview all my books for free, including the NYPD's Flying Circus, Cops, Crime, and Chaos. For my listeners out there, I apologize for getting this episode out late. My life is not my own right now. My six-year-old Irish Wolfhound is going through kidney failure, so I couldn't schedule a guest, but I have found some free time today, so I want to talk about one of the cases that I worked on. It's probably the biggest case I worked on. I've talked about this on other podcasts. It was the Audi A6 case, and it's funny. I always talk about like one of the movies that influenced me into becoming a New York City police officer and later a detective was the movie The French Connection. And it's a great movie. It was made in 71, I think. But the thing about that movie, unlike movies that you see nowadays, at the end of the movie when they take the case down and they grab most of the bad guys, no one is satisfied. The cops aren't satisfied. The bad guys aren't satisfied. It's almost as if once this big splash of a case came down, everybody either felt slighted or was pissed off. And that's kind of what happened with this case, even though it was a big splash and a lot of people got arrested and we broke up an international auto theft ring. So I might jump around a little bit. I didn't have time to take notes, so something might hit me and I might have to go back to something. But I've talked about this on other podcasts, so I'm going to let it rip. So it's probably about the summer of 1999 or the summer of 2000, I forget. And we're getting a lot of Audi A6s stolen. And this is around, you know, CompStat had popped up. So the NYPD now is really keeping an eye on statistics. And we're noticing this trend of Audi A6s, silver and black, and they're getting stolen. Well, I mean, in New York, you get a lot of cars stolen, but it's usually, you'll see a trend like with Honda Accords or Toyota Camrys, and you usually find the cars dumped somewhere. We call it the bones. You'll find the shells, you'll find the car on, say for argument's sake, the rims on the new Honda Accords is a hot ticket item. You'll start finding these stolen Honda Accords dumped somewhere on blocks with the wheels missing. But we weren't finding anything. These cars were just basically vanishing off the face of the earth. So we start reaching out to other police departments. And I remember we called a couple of small towns out in New Jersey. And they're like, yeah, we just got hit last weekend. Actually, they hit a car dealership and they took 10 Audis at once. I'm like, wow, right? And we call up Westchester County. And they were kind of coy. We called the Westchester County DA's office. And they were a little coy. They were like, yeah, we seem to have a problem with that. But they weren't saying much. And so we're keeping an eye out for these cars. And one of the Audis, of all these, you know, 40, 50, 60 Audis that were getting stolen, one turned up, I think it was abandoned right off the Triborough Bridge. I guess it had died after they had stolen it. And the New York State Police had recovered it. And, you know, I'm saying to myself, what is the New York State Police doing in Queens recovering a car? I mean, the New York State Police, do they have an investigative unit? Yeah, but they tend to work upstate. You don't usually see New York State troopers in the five boroughs. They're allowed to come in, but it was just odd. So I saw this Audi A6 was recovered by this New York State DMV investigator. And I call and I leave him a message. And I call and I leave another message. And I'm like, this guy is ducking me. So what winds up happening is, my lieutenant tells me and another guy, you know, you guys got to start working on this. And he starts pooling our resources, getting a bunch of detectives. We're going to try to figure out what's going on. What winds up happening is this car thief gets busted up in Rockland County. The Palisade Mall had just opened up. And this guy got grabbed trying to boost, I think it was a BMW. And I think it was Clarkstown that grabbed him. And they started making phone calls, you know, well, this guy's from the five boroughs, he's a car thief and he wants to talk, and, you know, whatever he's got, they're not really equipped for it. So they reached out to us, the state police, and the Westchester County DA's office. And it was funny, we all kind of converged at the same time at this meeting. And here's this guy, He was on lifetime parole from Florida for domestic violence, and he starts spilling his guts, and he says, I'm with this group of guys, and we steal Audi A6s, and we bring them out to Brooklyn. So he says, well, how does the operation work? And this guy was basically a thief and a driver. He really wasn't in the know of how the operation worked, but he knew enough to point us in a direction. Basically, he said there was a Jamaican guy named Ian, and he was up in the 4-7 area. And Ian would pay the thieves between $500 and $1,000 a car, and they would steal the cars. They would park them in the Bronx. They'd let them cool off for a couple of days. Then they would get a phone call. It was usually in the morning. They would take these Audis, these stolen Audis, out to this park out in Brooklyn and basically leave them there and just leave. They weren't supposed to know where the cars were going. It was very hush-hush. But this one guy said one time they were short a driver, and he said it was the oddest thing. He goes, I go out to Brooklyn. I pick up the car. He goes, I drive it literally a couple of blocks away in this garage, he goes, and there's all these Chinese guys. And he goes, there's shipping containers. He goes, it's a big operation. So we didn't know whether to believe him or not, but he was on lifetime parole and he wasn't going anywhere. So he starts telling us about Ken. He gives us Ken's phone number. He tells us about the main thief, this guy Mario Lopez, which we knew Mario Lopez. Everybody in the auto theft world knew Mario. Mario was a prolific car thief. Stole for a lot of people. He stole for chop shops, body shops, you name it. Mario was a thief. So once we heard his name thrown in the mix, our ears perked up. So we decided the Westchester County District Attorney's Office was going to prosecute the case, and the NYPD was going to supplement what was going on in the five boroughs, and then Westchester and the New York State Police were going to handle what was going on in Westchester. But since the cars were getting shipped out of Brooklyn, It was a joint effort with everybody. So what the Westchester County DA's office did was they got a wiretap on the main thief, Mario's phone, and they got a wiretap on this guy, Ken's phone. And through Ken, they were able to determine that Ken was basically a middleman. What he would do is he had all these people in the Bronx that needed car parts and tires and stuff, so he would farm out assignments for these guys to steal for him. So through Ian's phone, we were able to go up. Ian was getting these phone calls from an Asian gentleman. From that, we went up on the Asian gentleman's phone, and the operation worked like this. This guy, Min Jin Yang, was a military intelligence officer, supposedly X, but I don't know how X you can be from doing something in China and then move to the United States. He sets up shop in Brooklyn, and he meets Ken at a salvage yard, and he tells him, hey, I need cars. So what Ken does is he pays Ian, the Jamaican guy from the Bronx, $5,000, leaves between $500 and $1,000 and pockets the rest. And again, the orders was for Audi A6s, silver and black. And we couldn't figure out why. We figured, what are these guys, like Oakland Raider fans? But then we surmised that it's probably for government officials. So these guys would go out and steal the cars, they would park them, and then they would bring them out to this warehouse. And in this warehouse on Metropolitan Avenue in Brooklyn, you had Asian nationals working. And what these guys would do is the cars would come in, stolen vehicles, they would sometimes fix the ignition locks that were broken, clean them up, put them in showroom condition. They would drive them into a shipping container, they would let the air out of the tires so the vehicles would sit low. Then they would build a wooden frame above it and then hoist a second vehicle to put in there. So each shipping container contains several stolen vehicles. They had a phony bill of lading. I think that they said that they created paperwork that it was a toy factory in Brooklyn. So if customs looked, it was supposed to be filled with toys. And this guy was a great paper guy, like nothing would ever come back to him. So once the containers were filled in this garage out in Brooklyn, a legit trucking company would come, pick up the container, bring it out to Newark. Out at Newark, the containers were put on trains, and then they were railed across the United States, and they went to Long Beach, California, and then they were put on cargo ships and sent out to Shanghai, where they were offloaded and sold for probably a hell of a lot more money than $5,000. So this was going on for a while, and with the long before we caught on to this, they had several other warehouses, but what they would do is if they even smelled the police, they would close up shop at a moment's notice, shut the operation down for 6 months, sometimes a year. and then go back to business. So we're on these guys' phones. We're on Mario's phone. We're on the Jamaican Guyan's phones. We're on the Asian phones. And we quickly realize that in addition to being prolific car thieves, our thieves are into a lot of things, including murder for hire business. And they're talking about whacking this guy and killing that guy. And what we finally figure out that one of the thieves in this group, this guy Fausto Gonzalez, who was a sociopathic killer, he would kill you for as low as $5,000. And he did contract hits. One of the hits he did was, there was this guy that was head of, well, to go back 10 years before this Audi A6 case, there's this guy up in Connecticut who was in charge of, or is a bigwig in the motorcycle gang, the Savage Nomads. And he lends some money to this other guy that wants to start a drug business. And he's, I guess, loan sharking with the guy. And the guy from the Savage Nomads goes to jail for a couple of years. He gets out. He goes back to the guy he lent money to. And he says, well, I want to be paid. And I want you to support my motorcycle gang. And this guy basically pats him on the head and says, yeah, yeah, sure. He's paying him in drips and drabs. He's not really showing him respect after this guy had lent him all this money. Because now he's a big-time drug dealer in Hartford. So what this guy does is, from the Savage Nomads, he kidnaps one of his couriers. Puts him in a storage facility for a weekend, tortures this guy, takes his drugs, kicks him in the ass, and he sends him back to the guy that owes him money and says, listen, I'm not screwing around. Next time, you know, someone's going to get hurt. So this guy, this drug dealer says, oh, we can't have that. So what he does is he gets in contact with this guy, Mario Lopez and Fausto Gonzalez and a couple other guys, and they devise, they're going to murder this guy from the Savage Nomads. So what they do is they follow the guy around. They know what kind of car he drives, and they set him up. The guy that owes him money calls him up one day and tells him to meet him at his garage. So the Savage Nomad guy goes up to the garage. They have a meeting, and when he leaves, he drives off the set. Mario and Fausto pull up on a motorcycle. They empty a Glock into this guy. They take off. They dump the gun in a lake. They put the motorcycle in a U-Haul truck while everybody's looking for this motorcycle involved in a homicide. It's in a U-Haul truck going back down I-95 to the Bronx. Well, I forget if they chopped it up or tagged it or did something with it. Another murder Fausto did was, and this was an unsolved murder that happened about 97. You had this guy that owned a restaurant and a couple of clubs in Manhattan. And he had just purchased a new motorcycle. And he's driving around Manhattan. And what Mario, Fausto, and these guys would do is they would drive around in packs on motorcycles. And if they saw a guy on a bike that they wanted his bike, they would surround him with their motorcycles. So if you were just driving by and you seen this guy getting surrounded with motorcycles, you figure, oh, it's you know, a bunch of his friends catching up to him. Fausto would get off the bike and put a gun in your ribs and say, if you don't get off the bike, I'm going to shoot you. Well, this guy didn't get off the bike fast enough, and Fausto killed him. And then Fausto couldn't figure out how to drive around the guy with the bike, so he ran him over. Another hit that Fausto did was, there was a pharmacist, an elderly guy up in Spanish Harlem, that somebody had told Fausto that this guy, like, you know, he'd take the cash receipts at the end of the day to a night deposit box, and Fausto killed this old man. In addition to these homicides, these guys were also big-time burglars. And one weekend during our case, we knew they were going to do something, but they were very cryptic on the phone, so we weren't able to catch them in the act. But what they did was they rented a U-Haul truck, and one weekend they drove down to Virginia, and they went to this Harley-Davidson motorcycle dealership in the middle of the night. They cut power to the place, and they stole everything in this dealership that wasn't nailed down. I'm talking jackets, helmets, parts. If the motorcycles weren't fully assembled, they took them, and they put everything in. They filled this 26-foot U-Haul truck, drove it back up to the Bronx, and they stored it in one of their buddies, this guy James King's garage. And they were selling the parts and the motorcycle equipment piecemeal out the back of this guy's garage. Well, a couple of the neighborhood kids figured out, well, these guys got stolen motorcycle stuff. Who are they going to run to? The cops? So what they did was they broke into the garage that housed all this stolen stuff from the burglary in Virginia, and they stole a bunch of stuff. Well, this guy James King, and I think the other guy's name was Charles Dargan, they didn't like it. So they went and killed this teenager in the middle of our case. So they got pulled off the playing field very early on. But there was more than enough car thieves. I think in total during this case, there must have been about 8 or 10 guys that were stealing for this Audi A6 case. Another story that came out of it, because when we took the case down, Mario, well, we'll get to that. But Mario told us that one time there was this guy that owned a Porsche. And he was a hedge fund guy up in Connecticut off of I-95. I think it was in Greenwich. And they wanted to steal this guy's Porsche. And they followed him and they figured out that every morning what this guy would do is he would park in this parking facility. I think it was one of these outdoor ones. And they waited for him, that he had an assigned spot. So what they did was they stole a van and parked it right next to his spot. This guy, you know, he's got his Egg McMuffin. He pulls into his spot 9 o'clock in the morning. He's getting out of his Porsche. Mario and Fausto approach him wearing motorcycle helmets out of a stolen van. They point a gun at the guy and they go, give me the keys. So the guy complies, thank God. He gave them the keys. Mario and Fausto handcuffed the guy. They threw him in the back of the stolen van. They took him in the back of the van, duct taped and handcuffed until finally somebody let him out. So these guys, in addition to being car thieves, were very dangerous people. So these guys are stealing probably about 5 to 10 cars a week. And it was funny because we're listening on the wiretaps and you could hear the cultural differences, because I remember it was in February and Ken, the Asian guy, is arguing with the middleman, Dean, because he wants more cars. And Dean says, hey, man, it's Valentine's Day. My boys want to be with the ladies. And you hear a pause. And then you hear Ken starting to scream at Dean going, I don't care about that. I need cars. I don't care about your friggin' Valentine's Day. So it was actually, there was some very funny conversations that you would pick up on a wiretap. Another one was Mario was going with his girlfriend to her uncle's funeral. And they're driving somewhere in the Bronx. And Mario's on his phone, which we have tapped. And Mario's like, calling one of his buddies, goes, I can't believe it. And his friend goes, well, what's up? He goes, you know, I've got that order for somebody in New Jersey. I'll never forget. It was a black Maxim and had Bose speakers with a black interior. And his friend goes, yeah. He goes, I just saw one parked. He goes, but aren't you going to a funeral? He goes, I got to get this car. So he makes his girlfriend pull over on the way to the funeral home. He jumps out. He boosts this Nissan Maxim with Bose speakers and drives to the funeral with it. Attends the funeral, goes to the cemetery and everything with this stolen Maxima, and then drives it out to New Jersey. And you heard him like, oh God, you have no idea how much shit I caught from my girlfriend because she had to go out to New Jersey with me so I would have a ride back. So there's a lot of funny things and facets to this case. So ultimately what wound up blowing up this case, because we were going in so many different directions with it. You had homicides, you had robberies, you had burglaries. There was whispers of drugs that we never really got into, but there was whispers of it. They got greedy. At one point, Ken, the Asian guy, wanted a couple of specialty orders in addition to the Audi A6s. So Dean told Mario, I need like 10 cars in one shot. So Mario said, no problem. Mario, before all this, had a job as, I think he was a doorman or a garage attendant, but he knew a guy that was a garage attendant on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, right off of the 96th Street exit. So he goes to his friend who works in this 24-hour parking lot, and he says, listen, how would you like to make $3,000? And his buddy goes, yeah, sure, what do I got to do? And Mario says, well, this is what's going to happen. He goes, one night this week, I'm going to come in with 10 guys. We're going to tie you up. I'll put you in the trunk of a car near the front of the garage, and we're going to take 10 cars. And when give us about a half hour that we're out of here and gone, he says, then start making a lot of noise in the trunk. Someone will find you. They'll call 911. And you tell the police you didn't see anything. You saw a bunch of guys with ski masks. They roughed you up. They threw you in the trunk. And that's all you know. So the guy goes, oh, this is great. So we're hearing this on the phone. So what we did was we had a van across the street, a surveillance van with a camera on it. We had a camera on the warehouse out in Brooklyn. So it was actually pretty funny. We're watching this on the camera. 10 guys go into the garage. They're in there for about 5 or 10 minutes. 10 cars come out. About a half hour later, the 911 call is coming over. I think it's the 19th precinct. They show up. They run in. They find the guy in the trunk of the car. They let him out. And we're watching on the other end in Brooklyn, where you're watching the 10 cars go into the garage at once. And that was their mistake, because up until this point, they were very careful. They would park the cars to cool off. This time, they drove all 10 in one shot. So that night, Mario's on the phone with, I think it was his uncle or cousin, and he says, listen, he said, did you sweep those cars and make sure they didn't have GPS or LoJack? And the guy told him, yeah, and he goes, well, no, don't yeah me, are you sure? And the guy goes, yeah, don't worry about it. Well, he didn't. So the following morning, one of the owners goes to the parking garage. His car got stolen in a robbery last night. So he goes to the 19th precinct, he files a report. They put the VIN number and the license plate, the 19th precinct puts the VIN number and the license plate into the system, and that activates the LoJack. So for those of you that don't know, LoJack was this revolutionary thing that started in the 90s. Yeah, car dealerships used to sell it, and it's a hidden beacon, basically, that's secreted somewhere in your car. You don't even know where it is. And when you report your car stolen, it activates the beacon. And I can speak for the NYPD. Every precinct had one or two police vehicles equipped with a LoJack detector. And it took a while to narrow down where the vehicle would be. You were almost like a submarine commander. You were like following these pings, and it would take a while, but you would eventually find where the car was. So they activate, the 19th precinct activates this LoJack device, and it starts pinging in the garage. And we've got a couple of detectives that are watching the garage from the camera. And the next thing they know, they see this precinct police car circling. This, I think it was a sergeant and his driver. They get out and they walk in. They walk into our international shipping garage, and we're like, oh shit, we can't believe this is happening, right? They run in, and inside the garage, there was like a false wall. So when you first came in, you couldn't really see anything. So these cops walk in and they asking these Chinese guys about cars. The Chinese guys pretend they don't speak English and they run out the back door. So the sergeant from, I forget what precinct it was in Brooklyn, him and his driver, they think they're heroes. They find all these stolen vehicles, they're high-fiving each other, they're calling up, they're using the phone inside the garage that we have tapped. So one of our detectives or supervisors calls the garage and tells them, you just blew up our case, and like, oh shit, we're sorry. Because when you work in organized crime, Macy's doesn't tell Gimbel's. The reason they created Organized Crime Control Bureau, which was the auto crime division is under that umbrella, is you don't want precinct cops knowing what's going on with a case. And it could be something as simple as, you tell, cops are curious creatures, and if you tell a cop that there's something going on inside a building but don't look, they're gonna look. They're gonna park by, they're gonna drive, sometimes they'll walk in. And then there's also the corruption aspect. That's why they created Organized Crime Control Bureau, because sometimes the precinct cops get a little too friendly with business owners and they don't know these business owners' background. You know, Uncle Joe that runs the candy store, you don't know he's a capo in the Gambino crime family. And, you know, you're running a plate for this guy because he's telling you that somebody rear-ended him and took off, where meanwhile you're running a plate for a guy that owes him money. So that's why they created the Organized Crime Control Bureau. So anyway, now all of a sudden it's, oh shit, what are we going to do? Because now the Asians, they're calling everybody. Everybody's taken off. Now the car thieves know the police hit the place. The Jamaican guy knows that we're involved in this. So everybody, it's all hands on deck. I'll never forget, we had an emergency meeting in the Bronx office, and everybody was like, you grab this guy, you grab that guy, because we were terrified that the Asians, who we really didn't have ID'd, we had them identified, but they all had fake names. The cars were registered to fictitious people. And as far as the factory workers were concerned, we didn't even know. All we had was surveillance photos of them, and we knew a street that we thought they lived on because they would go down this block and disappear into these buildings, but we didn't know anything about them. So we figured these guys could leave the country and our thieves could go underground, which is a pain in the ass, because now you want to have a nice press conference and show all the stolen cars. And if you don't arrest anybody, you kind of look like a jackass. So my partner and I were given the factory workers that nobody knew anything about. We're like, great, couldn't you have given us Mario or Fausto? We know exactly where they live and what time they go to bed. So from the Bronx, My partner and I drive out to Brooklyn. It's probably about 6 or 7 o'clock at night. It's the dead of winter. It's cold. And we're on this street and we're just circling it. We don't know what we're looking for. I've gotten a couple of looks at these guys, but I don't really know them. I've never really followed them. I've just seen a couple of surveillance photos. We don't know their names. And my partner goes, hey, Vic, I don't know if this is anything, but I just seen two Chinese guys or Asian guys walk out of the side of a building with suitcases. I said, are you kidding me? I slam on the brakes. I throw the car in reverse. We back up. And there's these two Chinese guys with suitcases, and they're all bundled up. And I walk over and we start talking to them, and they're pretending they don't speak a word of English. And I stuck my hand inside the guy's jacket and I could feel his heart going a million miles an hour. And sticking out of his top breast pocket is a plane ticket to Toronto. I says, okay. So let me back up. This is something I forgot to tell before. So the New York City Police Department has 40,000 members from every background imaginable. And when you go into the police academy, they ask you a lot of questions about your background. They want you to list what kind of jobs you had, what kind of experience you had, your family members, what languages you speak, because that can be used down the road. And fortunately for us, we had a bunch of Chinese cops that we pulled from patrol that spoke all these different Asian dialects. So we needed guys for that case that spoke Mandarin and Cantonese. And they were doing a lot. In addition to listening on the wiretaps, they were doing surveillance on the Asian guys because these guys lived in a Chinese neighborhood, so they blended in. So we called them on the radio and said, listen, we got two guys stopped with plane tickets to Toronto. A couple of our Chinese cops pulled up and they go, that's them. So we knew instantly. We threw the cuffs on them. And we were rounding people up all night. I mean, the shit hit the fan probably about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I didn't go home that night till probably 3-4 in the morning. And then the case again was being run out of the Westchester County District Attorney's office. Janine Pirro was the district attorney at the time. So the press conference and everything was going to be up done in White Plains at their headquarters. And we were up all night, went home, got a couple hours sleep. And then we show up for the press conference. And, you know, people see Janine Pirro on Fox News and they wonder, you know, what kind of person she is. What you see with her is what you get. I've sat in on meetings with her. I personally liked her. She's a tough cookie, but what you see is what you get. She doesn't bullshit. I found her really good to work with. She was very upset because they wanted that case to go in different directions. There was a lot more we could have gotten out of it. And she was furious that how did this thing get blown up overnight? Like, we were going to have a certain, you know, we were going to let this thing run maybe 6 months, a year, who knows, to see, you know, where the tentacles of this case went. And it blew up unexpectedly because a couple of cops from the precinct just kind of ran in there and kicked the doors in. And she wanted someone's head. And we had to explain to her, look, they were doing their job. It's, you know, she was very upset with the NYPD over that. And I could understand it. But at the same time, it was, you know, it's two cops doing their jobs. So everybody's been up from the night before. We're all goofing around. We're delirious. Like, we're happy we took down this case. But at the same time, everyone's exhausted, right? So we're going to do this press conference. And again, like I said, it was the NYPD, the Westchester County DA's office, and the New York State Police, right? So we're supposed to do this press conference and say, let's say for argument's sake, we're going to do it at 3. They're like, oh, we got to wait till 3:30 because I can't think of the title of the big wig from the New York State Police. Superintendent maybe is what it was. And they go, we're waiting on him. Like, well, what are we waiting on him for? He had nothing to do with the case. Like, yeah, but he's the representative. I'm like, you got the investigators from the state police here. Why do you need the superintendent? And it's just funny. Like, I've seen this so many times. Everybody wants to be at a press conference. And it's often the people that stand at that microphone and speak the most that know the least of what went on with the nuts and bolts of the case. They're just the figurehead, but boy, do they like to talk. And what's funny is, all of a sudden, I'm in the hallway, and the elevator door opens. And I'm telling you, two of the largest men I've ever seen in my life. These guys, two New York State troopers get off the elevator, and they had to have been 6'8". I mean, I'm not a tall man. I'm 5'9", but these guys were a good foot taller than me, right? And then they're wearing them big cowboy hats. So you got these two huge state troopers, followed by this elderly gentleman who's the superintendent. And I'm like, you believe this stuff? Like, they couldn't just find two normal sized guys? But nope, everything is a show. And what's funny is, I tell this in a story from one of my books. We did a case takedown where we recovered, I don't know, 30, 40 stolen vehicles. And we were going to do the press conference at the Whitestone Pound. Would you believe that the commanding officer of the Whitestone Pound was pissed off that we didn't give him advance notice because he wanted to be there for the press conference? It's like, you're the commanding officer of a parking lot. And you think that you've got something to say or you want to be recognized? I mean, first of all, the guys that work at the Whitestone Pound, not all of them, you have civilian workers there, but that's not like a coveted assignment. Like the court system, the Whitestone Pound during my time, were there guys that wanted to work there? Yes, there were. But there were a lot of people that worked there that were being punished. So like in the NYPD, if you get jammed up and they haven't figured out what to do with you yet, or you're going to get fired or suspended or whatever, they ship you off to a place like the Pound. So it's not a coveted place that you're supervising the parking lot with a bunch of guys that don't know their fate. But anyway, this commanding officer from the Pound showed up and he wanted his, you know, he wanted his 10 seconds of fame. So anyway, we have this press conference and it's funny, like we recovered something like, there was probably 10 cars at the garage out in Brooklyn. And then there were cars at sea that we were able to bring back, believe it or not. Like the cars that went out to Shanghai, they were gone. We were never going to get them back. But the cars that were out at sea at the ships, I guess somehow they went through nautical navigation or something. They were able to bring a lot of these cars back. And it was funny. There was another press conference and a whole bunch of hoopla like months later when the cars started showing back up at the port out in Newark. But like I said, the end of that case was like the French Connection. Like nobody really was happy. Piero wasn't really happy because she wanted the case to be bigger, and I understand that. The state police weren't really happy. We weren't really happy. But, you know, at the end of the day, we put away a lot of bad people. The Asians, I know they did jail time, and I think they were deported back to their country, if memory serves me correctly. He didn't want to go to jail for the rest of his life, so he cooperated. And Fausto was convicted of, he got convicted of a federal homicide, you know, going across state lines to do the homicide in Connecticut. And then the Manhattan District Attorney's Office indicted him and prosecuted him. And I think he was convicted for 5 or 6 homicides in the borough of Manhattan, 13 and 15 homicides. But again, nobody was really happy at the end of the day. You know what? What I'm probably going to do is in the coming months, I'll bring on a couple of guys that I worked on this case that we can talk more about it. I'm just kind of like going off the top of my head and the nuts and bolts of it. But, you know, that's my Audi A6 case from, I think it was like 2000 or 2001. So we're going to wrap this up, and I want to thank everybody for tuning in, especially my listeners in Dallas, Texas, Newport, Vermont, Dublin, Ireland, I'm half Irish, and Nina, Wisconsin. If you work in law enforcement, like to be a guest on the show, drop me a note on Twitter and Instagram, @VicFerrari50. And, you know, I'd love to have law enforcement people on from different departments, just, you know, to know what it's like, how the other half lives. If you're enjoying the content on the show, check out my Amazon author page. Type in my name, Vic, Ferrari Like the Car, where you can preview all my books for free, including NYPD Law and Disorder. And hopefully before Christmas, I'll have my new book out. It's called NYPD, Laughing in the Line of Duty. It's funny. It's got a lot of funny stories and interesting take on the New York City Police Department. And thank you all for tuning in. Sorry that I got the episode out late, but it's Friday. And I'll have another episode out soon next week. Take care.